Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. On this episode, a conference taking place February 25th on the University of New Mexico campus will focus on Alzheimer's and resources for patients and caregivers. We'll talk with the organizers. We'll also talk with the founder of the Memory and Aging Center here at UNM about the impact of dementia and Alzheimer's here in New Mexico and how it's working to fill the gaps in care and research. And we'll check in with a researcher we talked to last year, who is part of a team at UNM working on a vaccine for Alzheimer's. First, Charles Fuscillo is the CEO of the Alzheimer's Foundation. It's holding a public conference at the Student Union on February 25th. Find out more at KUNM.org. What will happen at the conference?
So what's important is that the general public attends this because there's more than 41,000 people in New Mexico currently living with Alzheimer's disease. We're going to have several informative sessions that are led by caregiving experts and researchers. And the first guest speaker will talk about the current state of research throughout the entire country, provide best practice tips to those caregivers as well. And then we're gonna go into a workshop about long-term care. And it's critically important that people have a greater understanding about how to create a long-term care plan for their lives as well. You know, so anybody who wants to learn about Alzheimer's disease, learn about the current resources that are available, learn about our helpline that's staffed by licensed social workers. When Alzheimer's disease walks into your front door, whether it's you who's infected by it or the caregiver, life is never the same, and you don't need to go on the journey alone.
Alzheimer's, as you said, affects about 41,000 New Mexicans and nearly 5.8 million people nationwide. Can you just talk a little bit about the impact?
It's devastating. You know, this is a national epidemic that Washington needs to fully recognize. You know, this year and this year's budget, they're appropriating $2.8 billion for research, which is a record amount. And it sounds like a lot of money, but a one trial can cost nearly $1 billion. 5.8 million people, use a multiplier of 3 or 4 for the caregiving team, and you could see how widespread it is. More than 20 million people it affects. It costs more than $250 billion a year to provide caregiving to individuals living with Alzheimer's disease. So it's so prevalent, it's devastating for a caregiver. The physical and emotional stress is overwhelming. We always educate caregivers how to take care of themselves and to avoid caregiver burnout.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. That was Charles Fuscillo, CEO of the Alzheimer's Foundation. You can find out more about the group's conference on February 25th at KUNM.org. Now we turn to Dr. Gary Rosenberg. He's a professor in the neurology department and the founder of the Memory and Aging Center at UNM, which opened in 2016. Why did you create the Memory and Aging Center here at the University of New Mexico?
Yeah. The need is enormous. There's very little training or thought as to how we're going to deal with this, what some people call a silver tsunami. New Mexico is particularly vulnerable because it has an aging population and a lot of the younger people are leaving. It's going to reach a crisis, and everybody predicts by 2050 we're going to be spending $1 trillion a year on aging problems. Where that's going to come from, nobody knows. So NIH has a lot of energy put into this. The federal government is, of course, interested. And the question is, how are we going to get through this?
What kinds of services do you provide?
We have now a clinic, which is part of the hospital. And we have 3 neurologists, which is quite good for a state this small, that are particularly interested in the care of patients with dementia. One, Janice Knoefel, who actually wrote the major textbook on geriatric neurology, and she's an expert on Alzheimer's disease. John Adair is a behavioral neurologist, which is studying all different types of dementia, not just Alzheimer's disease. And I'm an expert in vascular dementia. So we have a well-rounded group seeing patients, providing care, and we're also involved in some major research programs.
Why do New Mexicans face particular challenges dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's?
Yeah, well, New Mexico is one of those states with lots of land and very few people, it's hard to find physicians that understand the aging brain and have the skills to take care of these patients. Albuquerque has some physicians and has us now, but once you leave the Mecca, if we call ourselves a Mecca, there's very little information about what to do with these people and how to care for them. And it's routine for me in my clinic to see someone who drives down from Raton, and then the next patient will have driven up from Las Cruces. So it's a real hardship to get care in the state. And it's almost impossible in the American Indian part of the state where resources are really limited.
What are some of the warning signs of dementia that family members should perhaps be aware of?
Yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation out there. It is not normal to lose memory as you get older. We used to call it senile dementia, which is a very bad term because it just means you're older and you're getting demented. No, it's a disease that you catch. Now, there are early forms of it which are not necessarily pathological, and this is what confuses people. Particularly, I think most people have trouble remembering names, and people get nervous, particularly if they have someone in the family with one of the dementing illnesses. It makes them nervous. So there's a certain amount of memory change which goes on with aging. I think most of it is due to what I call slowness of pulling information from the brain rather than actual inability to find it. So to me, I'm more worried when somebody tells me the boss noticed that they weren't filling out the forms properly, they weren't showing up for work, they weren't getting the work done. The spouse says, you know, he's just apathetic. He's not interested anymore. He doesn't remember that I told him we're going to see so-and-so on Tuesday night. So these
Wait a minute. My husband says that to me. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make a lie.
Yeah. Well, this is absolutely the problem. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of people that are worried. But when we get through testing them and talking with them, they're not at a point where I'm worried. The people that I'm worried are the ones who are not aware at all of what's going on. So it's a complicated initial visit. When do you want to actually come and see somebody with memory, so-called memory problems? And how do you convince somebody that you think they're having memory problems, but they don't? And I see a lot of people brought in by their spouse, by their children, and they tell me the patient says everything's fine. It's a fine balancing act in the beginning to see who really needs help and who doesn't. And that's what we do. We spend a lot of time trying to understand through cognitive testing, through imaging, through lifestyle information, if the person really is at risk. Of course, there are some, and those are the people that we like to either get into our studies or get on a medication. But a fair number of people are just come back in 1 year and we'll see how you're doing, so-called subjective memory loss, which means that they experience it, but we can't find anything on testing.
Because there are some afflictions that might mimic some of the symptoms of dementia?
Absolutely. B12 deficiency, thyroid deficiency, syphilis, AIDS, infectious disease, lupus. We try to screen for medical conditions that are treatable. There are stages of cognitive impairment. So when we see somebody, the first term we use is subjective memory loss, this inability for us to test a deficit or find a deficit, but the person themselves. And I'll give you an example is I see people from Los Alamos, these Nobel Prize, not quite Nobel Prize, but close to
in that category. Yeah,
Nobel Prize people that have started companies and they may have IQs, 180, who knows. They're quite high. When they begin to have problems, they know it. They're not remembering things as well, but there's no way we could test them. A normal IQ is 120, and most of us are around that range. So the things that we test wouldn't show up. So it's mainly their reporting. So mm-hmm. that's subjective memory loss. When it gets to a point where people are actually showing up deficits on our cognitive testing, we use the term mild cognitive impairment. That's a mid-stage. That can go on forever, can get worse. It doesn't necessarily get better, but it implies that there is something more serious going on. Eventually, we use the term dementia or Alzheimer's disease, if we think it's that or one of the other causes. The whole process can be anywhere from 5 to 15 years. And then, of course, there are the ones who have personality change first, and that may be part of the brain, more the frontal lobe. We call that frontotemporal dementia. Or people that are having gait problems, Parkinsonian problems, along with the dementia. Usually the dementia begins first, and then the personality and the movement problems. And that's more like what we now call Lewy body, which is a pathological term that we see in the brain at the autopsy, Lewy body dementia. And there's some other ones that we don't understand at all that are pathologically evident when we do autopsies, different proteins that get deposited, and we can't really diagnose those. So that's one spectrum. That's the spectrum of Alzheimer's disease. On the other hand, there's dementias due mainly to vascular disease. And these are due to longstanding hypertension, diabetes, lipidemia, sleep apnea is a major cause now that we're recognizing more and more. And these tend to be diagnosed more by the clinical progression, which is more motor function, balance before the memory problems, and also by our MRI testing. And this has been the major advance in the part of our major studies right now are these ways to diagnose the vascular component. So why is it important? So you have the Alzheimer process, which is laying down proteins in cells, killing them, and then the vascular process, which is actually destroying certain parts of the brain, primarily what we call the white matter, which is the deeper part of the brain. And those symptoms are different, and it's important to try to separate those two out, if possible, because the treatments are different. But even more important is when they come together, they accelerate the whole process by turning on an inflammatory response that's more extreme. And we call that mixed dementia. And it turns out when you look at pathology of large numbers of so-called Alzheimer patients, 50 to 70% of them have mixed pathology. Which means that's a way we could treat the vascular disease, even though we don't have yet a treatment for the Alzheimer protein disease.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Rosenberg, founder of the Memory and Aging Center at UNM. The center opened in 2016 with the goal of helping meet the growing needs of patients with dementia and to advance research on dementia, including Alzheimer's.
So you can treat vascular dementia?
Yes. Very effectively.
Yeah, interesting.
But you have to start when you're 40.
Okay, how would they know whether to come in when they're 40?
Well, there's some interesting studies now that are coming out, long-term studies. It's mid-age vascular disease that leads to late vascular disease brain changes.
So you have to get things like high blood pressure under control early.
Yes. I've become more of a general practitioner in because what we're dealing with is it's really a public health issue. I feel like I'm a little bit on a soapbox, but if you live in Canada, 70% of people have their blood pressure controlled. In America, it's 50%.
Wow.
which means when you translate that into public health numbers, there's really an epidemic coming of vascular disease. And it's not just high blood pressure. It's obesity, which leads to diabetes, which leads to vascular disease, which leads to kidney failure, which leads to hypertension. That spectrum is huge in the South, the so-called stroke belt, where everybody eats very poorly, doesn't exercise, very high incidence. It's creeping across the country. New Mexico used to be a state without much obesity and with, you know, reasonable exercising people. Nowadays, we are no longer. We're one of the red states. That means we're in the obese range, and particularly in the American Indian population. So poor diet, lack of medical care, untreated hypertension, which if you have obesity, that also leads to sleep apnea. All these things come together, and by the time you're 60 or 70, your brain has been damaged. Mm. And that's the vascular type of dementia, which I think, again, I'll get on my soapbox, if we had continued Obamacare, which was preventing disease rather than treating acute disease, was focused on these kinds of problems. If we had continued that rather than this disaster that we're facing of no medical care, we can only anticipate a much higher number of people that will be demented in the next 20, 30 years because we're not giving kids in elementary school, gym, we're not using tools that we have that are very inexpensive to prevent diseases that are very expensive later on. And this is, I think, a tragedy of our inability. Other countries are doing this very well.
This is a fairly new center, the Memory and Aging Center. Where do you see this going?
NIH reached a crisis, I would say 2013, 14. They had set up over 30 Alzheimer's centers. They were going after one concept, which was the amyloid.
Mm-hmm. The amyloid plaques in the brain.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they found a composition of the amyloid plaques, and then they started making drugs to get rid of them and remove the amyloid. In the past 4 years, from 2013 on, these huge studies have come out, $100 million studies run by drug companies and NIH, all failed. All of the amyloid studies failed. They could remove the amyloid from the brain, but they couldn't cure the cognitive process. So they switched their thinking, and they started thinking about alternate pathways. And, of course, vascular disease was one. And another pathway that has been now emphasized is what's called neuroinflammation. And this is just the brain responding to an aging, dying cell and creating an internal type of inflammation. Mm-hmm. So now the emphasis is to find ways to impact that. And that's where a lot of the research money is now going. They set up around 2013, 2014, the shift occurred from the National Institute of Aging, which had been funding the 30 or so, now there's more, 30 or so Alzheimer's centers, to the National Institute of Stroke, of Neurological Disease and Stroke. And that institute said, we're not going to do it the same way. We're not going to set up these separate silos all working on one theory. We're going to put everybody in the same group. So they created a consortium of seven centers with one coordinating center. It's a very good group. Once a month, we're all talking to each other. For the first couple of years, we were finding biomarkers to predict early disease. We're heading towards a study. We don't have the drug yet, but I'm sure there'll be some things to try. And they won't be amyloid. Mm-hmm. That may be added in to some people that have early onset Alzheimer's disease when we identify them. But the major group is going to be this combination vascular or the mixed, and that's the group that I think is going to respond to treatment. So we're pretty excited. Our imaging center affiliated, or we work with the people of the Mind Research Network, they have the best imaging in the world. I know it because they use our imaging team to advise this whole group.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, it's very nice. We also have the best biochemistry.
Do you foresee your center or the group as a whole working on all these things, but also pushing this public health message? Because that seems huge.
NIH is still investing in Alzheimer's. So they put out a request for proposals for what they called exploratory Alzheimer's centers. A real Alzheimer's center is a huge operation. You have to have a team of experts. You need to have big population. And we're not at that stage. But they put out a request for what they call an exploratory. Instead of 5 years, it's a grant for 3 years to build the infrastructure to make it possible to become a full Alzheimer's center. So we put that grant in, and we'll know in May.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a game changer.
What would that do?
Well, it would bring a lot of resources into the state. What we plan to do at the Mind Research Network, they have two mobile MRI scanners. So we've proposed to take those out to Indian country and do everything right there. Do the workup, do the testing, do the neurological exam, do the high-level imaging, and then find those patients that we can change either their lifestyle or get them on a drug or bring them into a study. So we're optimistic. We don't know what NIH is going to do with that, but at least that's the direction that I think would be helpful to the state. And it's not just, of course, the American Indians. It's also the underserved Latino population. And even more important in terms of these diseases is just poverty. So there's a lot of emphasis on getting care down to a lower level. Now, if just think about it for a minute, and this is something as a chair of neurology I dealt with all the time. If I had a patient who had seizures and they were also kind of on the edge of the poverty level, and for a couple of months, instead of buying a $100 pill, $20 pill a month, they didn't buy it, and they're in the hospital, and it's $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 multiple times a year. So those are the kind of things that if we can get in front, and that's the public health mm-hmm. message, you know, what kind of a country is it where we don't value health and education? And that's where we're headed right now. So I think public health-wise, I'm not one of these advocates for Medicare for all and that sort of thing, but I do think I've practiced enough in countries where there is full adequate coverage for everybody and the health of the country is better. I've been to Cuba twice, and I hate to say it, people think it's crazy, but they actually in many ways are better than us in terms of public health. They prevent disease because they can't afford to treat it. We are only geared to do the most expensive care at the wrong time. So all these things would impact the outlook of dementia in this country if we could get some forward-looking leaders who would recognize that.
That was Dr. Gary Rosenberg, founder of the Memory and Aging Center at the University of New Mexico. Last year, we also met a team of researchers who are working on a vaccine that could possibly prevent the tau tangles, one of the proteins that accumulates in the brains of Alzheimer's patients, which could prevent cognitive decline that comes with the illness. Nicole Mafis is a PhD candidate in UNM's Biomedical Sciences graduate program. She is working on the vaccine with Kiran Bhaskar, an associate professor in UNM's Department of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology, and Bryce Chakarian, professor and vice chair of molecular genetics and microbiology.
prior to submitting a future investigational new drug to the FDA, we wanted to validate our results and further extend them in other animal models. But just as a reminder, previously we tested this virus-like particle-based vaccine in a mouse model, which had a human mutated tau, and tau is the protein that we study, which is more linked to cognitive deficits and progression of Alzheimer's disease when it becomes misfolded. And our vaccine targets the misfolded type of tau. And in our previous work, we used these mice that were mature adult mice. And if you think about it in human years, they're about 20 to 30 years old. And after three injections, we waited only about 2 weeks in our mice. And then we tested all of our experimental manipulations and we saw amazing results, as I talked to you about in July. So the two different types of mice that we used, one of them had a similar mutated tau, and we intervened kind of early. But this time we gave them two dosage. And after two dosages, we waited 6 months. At this point, these mice are considered, quote unquote, middle aged. If you think about it, like a 40-year-old human. These mice have impairments in walking. And after intervention with this vaccine, we noticed their short, tiny little steps actually went back up to what we see in normal mice. So that was really encouraging. And then when the experiment was over, we looked at the brain itself, and we actually detected decreased levels of that misfolded tau protein that we study. And we also detected decreased inflammation in the brain. And so we were very encouraged by this, but we still wanted to do it a step further. So we decided to use a different animal model that has more normal progression of Alzheimer's disease. So these mice have a human tau protein that is not mutated and develops this pathology that we see in the brain much slower and more representative of Alzheimer's disease. And for these mice, we waited until they were kind of right before middle age, and we gave them two dosages only, and then we waited 6 months. So at this point, these mice are considered older age. They're like considered later stage age. And what we saw was a behavioral rescue in these mice, too. They investigated our novel object test more readily than the animals that received the control. They also experienced better movement in one of our mazes that we use. They were making more turns, which is more representative of animals knowing they've already been down this hallway before, so they're going down another hallway. And then when I looked at the brain of those mice, we also saw a decrease in this misfolded tau in the brains and also a decreased inflammation. So we have two novel results in two different animal strains, and we are currently working with Octave Pharma through a partnership with UNMSTC in order to help commercialize our technology and bring it into the clinicals realm at some point. We just received notice of award for a large grant that funds our lab, but part of this money, this $2.5 million grant that we just received, part of this actually funds this project. So we're going to be able to extend these results and do larger groups of mice, and then hopefully with more funding, be able to move into clinical trials.
That was Nicole Mafus, a PhD candidate in UNM's Biomedical Sciences graduate program. Find a link to our earlier conversation about the potential Alzheimer's vaccine at KUNM.org. There you can also find this episode and other episodes, as well as information about the upcoming Alzheimer's Foundation conference on February 25th at the University of New Mexico. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.